So in the parasha of Emor, there's a review of all the Yamim Tovim, all the special days, and it begins with what's not on the sheet, with the holidays that we've just experienced. Right, the holidays we've just experienced, there are two of them. One is called Pesach, and the other holiday is called Chag HaMatzot. Now, Pesach is the commemoration of the Korban Pesach. You remember that the Jews are instructed to bring a Korban Pesach on Yud Dalet, on the 14th day of Nisan. And that, I don't know where the sheets are. The Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, is instructed, each of us is instructed to bring a Korban Pesach on the 14th. And what we do is we slaughter it, and then we cook it. What is that called? You know. What? Sleeve. Well, what is that called in English? We roast it on a spit. And we roast it for a very long time. And we eat it on that night. We eat it that night. So that the first holiday is called Pesach. It's the Korban Pesach. Why the Korban? It's called Pesach, which means, according to the Torah, to jump over or to leap is something that we... something that we imagine we know the answer to, because the Malach HaMavet, the angel of death in Egypt, jumped over the Jewish houses and killed the firstborn in the Egyptian houses. Of course, it's not perfectly clear how this happened in actuality, because the Jews and the Egyptians didn't live together. Since the Jews lived in a special place in the land of Goshen, it's not clear why the angel had to jump over anything. And therefore, there are attempts to explain this Pasach more in the lines of Rashi, who said that Pasach, Pesamachet, means to be nervous about something, right? There was some kind of nervousness. But so the first holiday in Nisan is called Pesach. And it's connected to the Korban Pesach. And that overlaps another holiday that we call Chag HaMatzot. Right? Chag HaMatzot are the 7 days when we are, the first of the 7 days, we're directed to eat a matzah. Right? And that's what we do. We eat a matzah. The other 6 days, right, the other 6 days, we're directed not to eat chametz. So all 7 days, you can't eat chametz. So if you want to eat bread or something like bread, you have to eat matzah. You know that there is a position, the Vilna Gaon held that every time you eat matzah on Pesach, you're doing a mitzvah, right? Every time you eat matzah. Because there's a pasuk that says Shivat Yamim Tochlu Matzot, that you should eat matzot for 7 days. So the Vilna Gaon said that was, even though it's not a mitzvah that you have to do, but if you do it, you're doing a mitzvah, right? If you do it, you're doing a mitzvah. In modern times, today, there's also because of the Vilna Gaon, who apparently would have eaten matzah bread given the opportunity. I'm not sure that is. So, but today there's like a difference of opinion amongst Jews, thankfully. I mean, what else are we going to make life interesting about? If you eat matzah bread, are you doing something that's so terrible that it certainly couldn't be a mitzvah of any kind? And I always say it where I live, I like to make matzah bread and eat it, but I have to close the shutters before I do it, and declare a moratorium on guests, like no one can come in and out while I'm eating matzah bread. I was once in the Ramada, on Pesach, like, you know, Etz Chata'aya Nimaskir, I mean, to spend Pesach in a hotel for me is not the greatest thing in the world. But I was there once, and so we're eating, and so I sort of like consciously, I took the matzah and I started breaking it into my soup, which is what I had done my entire life. And the waiter comes over to me and he says, "You have to do that. I'll get you a paper plate." Now, of course, the exciting thing was that the waiter was an Arab. So this led me to think that there's hope for the future, because no matter how the peace talks will turn out, I can imagine the Arabs like teaching me how to keep Pesach. You know, it would be a new level of peace and quiet in the state of Israel. I mean, certainly the prime minister and his friends are not going to teach me much about Pesach, but this Arab waiter, he had it very clear. So we have a holiday called Pesach in the Torah, and the holiday called Pesach is connected to the Korban Pesach. And the Korban Pesach is started the day before what we call Pesach, right, during the middle of the day, and the roasting of the Korban goes up until very late in the evening, and at the end there's a mitzvah to eat the meat of the Korban Pesach al matzot umrorim, with matzah and maror. That's how we do it. But the holiday of the 15th of Nisan is called Chag HaMatzot. And you know that because when somebody gets up at the Seder to make Kiddush, he makes Kiddush because we have arrived at Chag HaMatzot. And Chag HaMatzot is the 7 days of our lives when we can only eat matzah and not eat chametz. We can eat matzah and not eat chametz, and the symbolism there is somehow that the matzah beats, that somehow we beat the chametz. We stop it from becoming chametz. You put the flour in the water, you make a little kind of cracker out of flour and water, you stick it into the oven, and you know, if you leave it there for a while, it'll become chametz, it'll rise, like everything does. But we take it out so fast that it doesn't rise. That's called matzah. Matzah is, we stopped it from becoming chametz, so that on Pesach, on the 7 days of what we call Pesach, which the Torah calls Chag HaMatzot, which the Chachamim call Chag HaMatzot, during those 7 days we eat matzah, and we avoid eating chametz. And matzah itself represents that avoidance, right? Because it's close, but it's not quite. Close, but not quite. Now, the Torah says, the Torah continues, once we know that these two holidays exist and that they overlap, right? They overlap on the first night of Chag HaMatzot, because at the end of that evening we eat a Korban Pesach. We call that Korban Pesach today Afikoman. We call it Afikoman, even though Afikoman represents really the fact that we haven't got a Korban Pesach. Not that we have a Korban Pesach, but that we haven't got a Korban Pesach. The Afikoman, as you know, is the most annoying part of the evening, because your children and or grandchildren who come back from yeshiva have very strange ideas about how much of it you have to eat after an evening of eating. You know, it's not as though anybody is hungry for a piece of matzah, but that's how it is. That's how it is. We're all tired, and we have some kids stole the afikoman. It's really a kind of a mess, but hopefully we get through it. The good thing about the afikoman is that we try to eat it before chatzot. Imagine if we had all night to do it, that would really be. In any event, Pesach and Matzah. Now we're looking at the parasha. We're looking at our psukim. So the Torah says, "Vayedaber Hashem, Vayedaber el bnei Yisrael l'mat alehem, ki tavo el haaretz. There's something about what is about to be stated, which is connected to ki tavo el haaretz, when you come to the land. Asher ani noten lachem, The word Omer is a measure. It's a volume measure for usually for things that are dry. A dry volume measure. How much exactly a Omer is doesn't interest us right now. I'm generally very bad on those things. And whatever they tell me to do, this is also my grandchildren, whatever they tell me, I do what they say. I never argue about measures. But they tell me something different every year. So I figure that somehow in silence I'm victorious. So he says, you cut down the standing wheat and you take an omer of it, Reshik Tzirchem El HaKohen. Ve'nif et ha'omer. Now it says, like, when do you come to the land? It doesn't say when yet. Pasuk Yud Aleph, Ve'nif et ha'omer lefnei Hashem le'etzonchem mimacharat ha'shabbat yinifenu ha'komen. So you bring the omer to the Kohen heaves it, like up and down, the Gemara says front and back, like, you know, like a lulav and an etrog, when you make the bracha and lulav and etrog, you heave it up and down and front and back. Actually, we've expanded it with the lulav and the etrog, and we do it in six directions, which is all there are, right, front and back, right and left, up and down. Well, that's the way it was when we take the lulav and etrog and before Hallel on Sukkot. That's usually the way we do it. People who make a bracha on the etrog outside of tefillah, like many women make a bracha on the lulav and etrog, they often don't do that. It's not part of the essential mitzvah of lulav and etrog. The essential mitzvah of lulav and etrog is to take it. U'lekachtem lachem. But this has been expanded in the time of the Gemara to include indicating God's dominion over the entire world. And it's kind of it turns into kind of a prayer. So that's the people who are davening are going to say Hallel. If you're going to say Hallel, then you do it that way. You know, the men got used to it and women didn't get used to it. Here the Pasuk says, Ve'niv et ha'omer l'pnei Hashem l'etzonchem, and then it says, V'mocharat ha'shabbat. And this was a problem for about 2,000 years. These words, V'mocharat ha'shabbat. Because everybody understands that the primary meaning of the word Shabbat is the seventh day of the week. The seventh day of the week is called Shabbat, and it recurs again and again and again. That's what Shabbat is. As opposed to Chag. Chag is something else. Chag has a date. Like Pesach starts on the 15th day of Nisan. Right, what we call Pesach. And I don't want to get... Chag HaMatzot starts on the 15th day of Nisan. Right? Now the 15th day of Nisan is a variable. You don't know when it's going to be. I mean, today, you have to understand everything has changed. I mean, we all know that. Today we have a calendar. And we can know the calendar for next year and the year afterwards. And, you know, if you know about the calendar, you know there's a 19-year cycle. So if you have 19 copies of the Luach, of what's called the Luach, you're covered forever. Because it just recurs every 19 years. So but in theory, when the month was determined by witnesses who saw the new moon, you have a recollection of that? That's the first mitzvah to Am Yisrael upon Yitziat Mitzrayim. The first mitzvah they received is called Kiddush HaChodesh, to establish the new moon. And the way you establish the new moon is by looking up at heaven. If you see it, you see a sliver of the new moon, you go running. You go running to to Yerushalayim. You go to the Beit Din and you tell them that you saw it, and they declare the new moon. So you know that it's variable, because what if it's cloudy and nobody saw the new moon? So the Rosh Chodesh becomes tomorrow and not today. And everybody understood that the month could be 29 days or 30 days, right? The last month. So if it's not 29, then it'll be 30, but that's it. So there's a variable aspect to the month. And therefore, there's a variable aspect to Pesach, what we call Pesach. We don't know what day it's going to come out on. In theory, you know, the time that there was a witness and a baked in and all of that. So we wouldn't know exactly when it would come out. We wouldn't know exactly when it would come out. So Shabbat and Yom Tov are differentiated by the fact that we know when Shabbat is going to be. It's going to be in another couple of days, and after that 7 days, and after that 7 days. It never varies. It never varies. There was this problem in modernity, you know, when the Jews got to Tokyo, and they weren't in World War II. World War II is not such a long time ago. I mean, it is, but not such a long time ago. But when they got to Tokyo, somebody told them that they had crossed that line, you know, the international date line. International date line, and nobody knew whether the international date line was halachically obligatory, and when everybody figured out that there had to be some date line, there'd be some time. Not everybody. This was already to be shown and talk about this earlier, a lot earlier in Jewish halacha, that there had to be some way of figuring out when the day and the night, what day it was in the daytime and what day it was in the nighttime. So they figured out something, but they didn't like it. And that's why the people from the yeshiva, that's part of the reason, but it's why the people, the Mir yeshiva that made its way to Tokyo, then went back to Shanghai. You know Shanghai? These are all cities controlled by Lubavitcher Shluchim. But they went back to Shanghai, because the Shabbos in Shanghai was the same as the Shabbos in Russia. And that was, the alternative would have been to keep Shabbos 2 days a week, which was not so practical, and then to fast 2 days on Yom Kippur, which was certainly not, you know, very practical. So they went back to Shanghai, where they at least thought they knew. Because they said it was like a mir where they came from. It was like Russia where most of the students came from. So that was all right. So now we're talking about the Mocharata Shabbat. The natural inclination would be for us to say that Mocharata Shabbat is the day after Shabbat, and Shabbat is a day that appears once every 7 days. And therefore, when would this whole business take place? Well, it will take place on the first Shabbat in Pesach, whenever that happened to be, right? But the tradition, the rabbinic tradition, is that the word Shabbat in this pasuk means Yom Tov, and therefore Mimocharata Shabbat means the day after Pesach. In other words, there's Pesach, which is a day that you can't do any work on, right? And then there's the day after the first day of Pesach, where at least in theory you can go out into the fields and harvest the new grain and bring it for the next morning, an omer of the new grain, or you bring it to the Beit HaMikdash. This, of course, you run into a problem. You run into a problem. That is, if the first day of Pesach turns out on Friday. No? You'll find that disagreeable? The first day of Pesach is on Friday. That means the day after the first day of Pesach is Shabbat. And harvesting the grain is forbidden on Shabbat. And therefore, the Mishnah, right, the Mishnah Menachot in the sixth parak called Rabbi Yishmael, the Mishnah discusses how are you supposed to do it if the first day of Pesach is Friday and the first day of Chol HaMoed is Shabbat. How do you do it? So the Mishnah offers various suggestions there, but the basis of the suggestion is that you should not harvest really more than an omer. You can't just go out there and cut down the wheat that you find in the field. You have to go out there and grab onto an omer's worth of it. And with a couple of people there, you harvest exactly the amount, or close to exactly the amount that you're supposed to bring to the Beit HaMikdash, so that the Kohen can heave it up and down on the second day of Pesach, which might be Shabbat. So that there are two things about Mimacharat HaShabbat that you have to remember, and that is one, that we have accepted the less obvious pshat, that Shabbat in this Pasuk means Yom Tov. And the second thing is that, in spite of the fact that this produces a problem which is never produced in the other system. If you say that Mimokrat HaShabbat is the day after Shabbat, you never have this problem. Because the day after Shabbat could be Yom Tov, but on Yom Tov you're allowed to do things for food. You're allowed to prepare food, and if this was a necessary kind of preparation, so that would be alright. The second thing that you have to know about this Korban, it says Pasuk Yud Bet. Well, let's look here, Pasuk Yud Aleph in Rashi. See Mimocharat HaShabbat? You see the Rashi? It's the sixth line in the Rashi, seventh line. Mimocharat HaShabbat, Mimocharat Yom Tov HaRishon Shel Pesach, as I just explained. Right? After the first day of Pesach. After the first day of Pesach, She'im Ata Omer Shabbat Bereshit, because Rashi says, if you would think that Mimocharat HaShabbat is referring to the Shabbat, the seventh day of the week, then the Pasuk, how do you know which Shabbat are you talking about? I mean, we know what the Karaites said, and we know what the Tzedukim said before that. But the Pasuk doesn't indicate, according to Rashi, which Shabbat of the year we're talking about. And since the Pasuk doesn't indicate which Shabbat of the year we're talking about, the traditional pshat, which is that it's the day after the first day of Pesach, the traditional pshat is more correct, let us say, acceptable, reasonable, understandable, good, right? All of those things. So it says, then it says in Pasuk Yud Gimel, Pasuk Yud Bet is that you have to bring an olah, right? An offering which is completely consumed, and then a mincha, a meal offering, and then the lechem, the talit, the kamel, lo tochlu at etzem hayom hazeh. And then the pasuk says an interesting thing, and that is what we call today chadash, that you can't eat anything that is made from the new wheat, the wheat that grew over the winter, right, and was in the standing fields on Pesach. You can't use that wheat until you bring this Korban HaOmer, which is like in an Omer's worth, and it's heaved by the Kohen, and when the Kohen heaves it, then suddenly something has happened in the galaxies of the halachic world, and that is that the wheat that you were not allowed to use suddenly became permissible. When was it permissible? After the Korban HaOmer was given. What time of the day was the Korban HaOmer given? We don't know. As early as possible. Doesn't have a specific time. Right, the Korban HaOmer doesn't have a specific time. But it's on that day. It's on that day. And when the temple was destroyed, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was asked, what are we supposed to do? I mean, when do we eat the new bread from the new wheat? So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, well, Zecher LaMikdash, in order that we remember what was going on once in the Beit HaMikdash, in order, because of that, Yom HaNeth Kulo Asur. We will, even though everybody knows that they brought the Korban HaOmer as early as they could on that day, on the 16th day, we can't bring the Korban HaOmer, and therefore we won't eat the Chadash, the new wheat, on the 16th, but we'll wait till the 17th. And that's what we do today. That's what we do today, and generally speaking, Chodosh is not a problem in Eretz Yisrael, at least has not been a problem in Eretz Yisrael. What used to happen was the wheat that we ate, the bread that we eat, that we ate was made of wheat that was imported from America and Canada, and by the time it got to Israel, it was long after the Chadash issue had come up. And wheat that was grown in Israel, I mean, the Rabbanut HaRashit, I don't know how this arrangement works today, but when I was looking into these things, the wheat that's grown to Israel is used to feed animals. And the wheat that's imported to Israel is used to feed the people. So that somehow Chadash was never really a big issue. I mean, they arranged it that way. It's not that... because there was a time when American Canada had tremendous excesses of wheat that were kept in silage, right, someplace in the Midwest. And by the time it came to Israel, it was long after the 17th or the 16th of the month of Nisan. Now that has changed. I understand. Now I'm getting a little fuzzy, but I think that in America, they don't quite produce that much grain. And they don't have the excesses that they used to have. But somehow we work it out. In America, however, Chagash has become all the rage. Also in England, little by little, you know, the English are a stiff-necked people. But even in England, it has like made its way into consciousness. So that in America, there's a fellow in Muncie who sits in front of a computer and tracks bales of wheat. Is that the right word? I don't mean bales. I mean sacks. Apparently, all the sacks of wheat in the United States of America are numbered. And therefore, you can know when they were born and how old they are. And if you know when they are born and how old they are, you could sort of avoid. Now, he also gives you the service of telling you which bakeries in the Northeast happen to have wheat that is not Chadash. Isn't that remarkable? You never thought of that. And in England, there was a Dayan who was very much, you know, into this. And at the beginning, they also claimed, I have to get this straight. There's a bakery in London that has several outlets called Grudzinski's. Mr. Grudzinski was a bit of a hothead. And when I asked him about it, he lost his cool. And he said, no problem, it comes from who knows where, Russia. You know, they get it from somewhere, and they're sure that everything is all right, even though the Dayan, who was inclined to worry about Chadash, said that was not exactly the case. Chadash is sociologically an interesting prohibition, because while it's true that amongst the Jewish people, that the Hasidim are more stringent than the yeshiva people, usually. Right, you know the Hasidim, they wear funny clothes. So, and they're very stringent in their funny clothes attitudes. They do it their way, and everything is their way, and they generally are able to impose their will on others. Because when you're certain about something, it's hard to beat you down. So the Hasidim don't care about Chadash. You believe that? They just don't care about it. And the yeshiva guys are nervous about it. Why is this? Because the Bach wrote a commentary on the tour. It's all like unclear, these words don't mean anything. But Bach wrote a commentary on the tour. Bach's name was Rabbi Yoel Sirkis. And Karl Bach always claimed that he was a direct descendant of the Bach, something that I would never checked out. But it could be, right? Why not? So the Bach wrote that the prohibition of Chodesh only exists for Jewish wheat. In other words, it's only if there's a Jewish farmer who grows the wheat and then cuts it down that the prohibition of Chodesh is applicable. However, if you have non-Jews who are doing this, and so it's quite all right. So the Bach invented a heter for all the Jews who today eat wheat that's made by, grown by, and harvested by non-Jews, that's not what the Torah is talking about. The Torah says, Ki tavo la'aretz, referring to the Jews who do this, who grow the wheat, that make the... And so the Hasidim accepted the position of the Bach. Now, why did the Hasidim accept the position of the Bach? So there's a story. There's a story which goes with this distinction. That they came to the Baal Shem Tov. Came to the Baal Shem Tov. You know the Baal Shem Tov? A very important person in the world of Hasidim. They came to the Baal Shem Tov and they asked the Baal Shem Tov, what are we going to do? How are we going to be able to make beer before Pesach? I mean, if you can't drink the beer, you can't very well be a chassid, can you? So the Bach says, after the Baal Shem Tov said, it's a heavenly decree. It's obvious that the Bach is right. Because God would not leave us without beer for such a long period of time. So there you have, the circle is closed. And the Hasidim accepted the heter of the Bach, parentheses, in order that they should be able to drink all the beer they wanted. And the Misnagdim, who were not so big on drinking, yeshiva guys who were not so big on drinking, I wonder what they did for fun, but they weren't drinkers, so they're nervous. They got nervous about Chodesh and everybody in America, and in England to a certain extent got nervous. And that's why in England the superior Hechsher, you know, there's a superior, every place you go there's a superior Hechsher. The way that you know that it's superior is that the people who give that hechsher can't speak the language of the land. I didn't know it was that funny. It was okay. The superior hechsher is given by people who don't speak the language of the land. So now the same Mr. Grzynski, whose hechsher is called, it's Kedasya. Kedasya in London or in England is like Satmar. It's like Satmar because they're a bunch of Satmar Hasidim. But it's like they include a few other people. They're like Satmar type guys. Everybody has a lot of faith in people who look like that to give you the best possible Hechsher option, right? So in England, Mr. Grzynski, who is not a Satma Chassid by any means. In fact, one might call him even modern Orthodox, Rachmana Litzlah. So Mr. Grzynski was getting annoyed by this whole business about Chodosh, and he knew that his wheat was not Chodosh, not because they had it organized. It was just a de facto situation. So Grzynski put a sign up in the bakery to the effect that there's no problem of Chodosh in anything that we make. And the Kedasya guys that were given the Hechsher, right, forced him to take it down. Because they said, you can't be matter of something that doesn't have to have a heter. Right? All the other people, all the Hasidim, would get nervous if they saw them. So they made him take down the sign. Yeah. You have a story? Appropriate story?
The pasuk seems to be quite precise about the fact that it's kashrut to Eretz Yisrael, the Kita Moila Aretz. Yet, from what you've been saying, it's a mitzvah which is Chalim Chutzla Aretz as well.
Yeah, it's Machlok is Tanoi. It's a Machlok is Tanoi in the Gemara and Kedushin. I mean, I don't want to get into that, but it is.
Okay.
So in any event, we're up to so we see that chadash is also a matter. It's not just an obligation to bring this omer to the Beit HaMikdash, but bringing the omer to the Beit HaMikdash is a matter. It allows you to eat what you weren't able to eat before. Just like shechita, when you shecht an animal properly, right? The animal becomes permitted, right? You can eat it. You can't just bite off a piece of the animal while it's alive and eat it. That's called Eivah Minachai or something similar, but you have to do something which makes the animal permissible to be eaten. Similarly, the wheat that grows in the land, either the land of Israel or the land, you're all over the world, is allowed only when you bring the Korban HaOmer. And therefore, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai thought that he has to relate to this even after the destruction of the temple. So that's what it says. You see that Pasuk Yudalit? It says, Bekol Moshvotechem. And Kol Moshvotechem could mean either every place you happen to be in Eretz Yisrael, or it could be every place you happen to be in the world. And then it says, Usfartim Lechem Yimocharat HaShabbat, B'yom Aviyachem Et Omer HaTnufa, Sheva Shabbatot Tmimot Tiyena. So now we are living, we move in, like almost without taking, like changing our stride, we go from the Omer, to Sfirat, what we call Sfirat HaOmer, but really we mean Sfirat Mei HaOmer. From the time that the Korban Omer is given, on that night we start counting 49 days. So the way the Torah sets it up, it would seem that there's some sort of connection between Sfirat HaOmer and what happened before Sfirat HaOmer, right? There was Pesach and Matzot, Chag HaMatzot, and then the Mitzvah of Omer in the Torah, and then Usfartim Lachem, you should count 49 days, and here again it says Shevet Ad Mocharat HaShabbat HaShvi'it, right? Shabbat Mocharat HaShabbat Shabbat. Well, we've already explained what Mocharat HaShabbat means in relation to the Omer sacrifice, so we could assume that Mocharat HaShabbat, again, when it comes to Sfirat HaOmer, means the same thing. So we have again, Chag HaPesach, which starts on Yud Dalet. Chag HaMatzot, which starts on Tetvav. The Chag of the Omer, which starts on the next day, the night after the Tetvav, which is Tet Zayin. And then we have Sfirat HaOmer, which starts at the same time. Now, Sfirat HaOmer is not clear. We understand Pesach somehow was the beginning of faith, as we have spoken previously, that Moshe Rabbeinu said, "Behem lo yaminu li," that this is the problem of Bnei Yisrael is a problem of faith. They don't have emunah, whatever that might mean. And we know that Yitziat Mitzrayim over time solved that problem, because it says after Kriyat Yamsuf, "Vayamir v'Hashem v'Moshe Abdo," that there was emunah that was instilled, and from this emunah, they derive certain mitzvot that have to be accomplished, to commemorate, to reflect upon, to be connected to. So we understand that Pesach is connected, we understand that Matzah is connected. And we now understand that Omer somehow connects the land mostly in Eretz Yisrael, when you come to Eretz Yisrael, to Yitziat Mitzrayim, right, that there is some kind of a connection. But what does Sfirat HaOmer, what could Sfirat HaOmer possibly have to do with whatever is going on in Yitziat Mitzrayim? Because Sfirat HaOmer seems to be, like I count 49 days until I'm able to say, this is the 50th day. And you know what happens on the 50th day? What happens on the 50th day? There's a sacrifice of chametz. Shtei halechem, just like the Omer was matir. The Omer was matir chometz, right? Not chometz, the wheat for Bnei Yisrael. the korban that's given on the 50th day is matir the chametz for the mizbeach. It's matir the chametz for the mizbeach. So this is like you have this connection, right? And we don't understand exactly where Sirat HaOmer comes into to this. So what I'd like to do is quickly describe to you how the Tanim Yafot, how the Tanim Yafot deals with this question. The Tanim Yafot is a book on Chumash that was written, it's a wonderful book, I can tell you. It was written by Pinchas Halevi Ish Horowitz, who was ultimately the Rav in Frankfurt. He came from, of course, from Eastern Europe, and became the Rav. He was a shaliach. He was a shaliach of the Chassidut. He was a shaliach of Chassidut, the Magid, the great Magid of Mizrich, who was the primary, I mean, again, here I'm not, not everybody would agree, but to a certain extent, he became the leader after the Baal Shem Tov. Whether he was the greatest Talmud of the Baal Shem Tov or not, that's something that you could continue to discuss after the Shir is over. But he was certainly either the greatest or very close to being the greatest. And without a doubt, when it came to organization, when it came to like being able to put something together, he was the greatest. So Pinchas Halevi Ish Horowitz, he was sent to Frankfurt, a place where no one ever heard of Chassidut or Chassidim or Eastern European Jewry, and he was there for a great number of years, and you know from his output, he had this tremendous output of Torah books. He wrote many books on Talmud, and he wrote on Chumash, and he wrote on Musar. He had this tremendous output, which, you know, reflects the fact that he was basically unsuccessful. If he had a lot of spare time, that's what I mean. If you are a successful rabbi, you don't have time. And if you're writing books, a rabbi writes books, has time for writing books, is probably not such a successful rabbi. That was the situation here. He was not able to convert, in spite of his great scholarship, which is how he got the job of being the rabbi in Frankfurt. In spite of his great scholarship, he was not able to convince the people in Germany that they should adopt a Hasidic demeanor in order to serve God better. He wasn't able to do that, as opposed to other great emissaries of the Magid Mizrich, for example, the Baal HaTanya, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, who was able to create Hasidut in the cities in which he lived. And what?
Not in Germany.
No, not in Germany. No, Lubavitch was in Lubavitch. Not in Germany. Germany was a hard nut for Chassidut to crack. And it remains, I guess, probably uncracked to this day. Even though Germany today is not a continuation, really, of Germany of yesteryear. But the Germany today is like a lot of Russian Jews and Israelis, like some combination of Russian and Israeli Jews. I guess there are a few real Germans there someplace, but not many. So this is what this is the Panim Yafot. So the first thing that the Panim Yafot says, I don't think we have time to read it, but I'll just tell you, I'll summarize what it says. The thing that I wanted to tell you is that the Panim Yafot is the Rebbe, he takes off from a Medrash. The Medrash says this. he says a person should not treat the mitzvah of Omer as an insignificant one. Sha'al yidei mitzvah to Omer, listen to this. Zocha Avraham Avinu Nirasha Eretz Kanaan. He says, because of the mitzvah of Omer, right, that Avraham Avinu merited the land. He inherited the land of Kanaan. And that's what the Pasuk says, means when it says, Tati chazarecha eretz migurecha. Almanat vata et briti tishpon reizuso mitzvah ha'omer. So even though when you read the parasha in Lech Lecha, when you read the parasha in Lech Lecha, it sounds like Avraham Avinu is inheriting the land because of the mitzvah of Milah, of Bris Milah. And yet the Medrash says, no. Avraham Avinu is inheriting the land because of the mitzvah of Omer. Now, of course, you know, you have to have a certain kind of way of looking at things. I mean, something that just doesn't fit together. It just doesn't mean anything. What does Avraham Avinu have to do with Omer? What does Avraham Avinu have to do with the mitzvah of Omer? There's no indication, unless you say that Avraham Avinu kept all of the mitzvot, but there was certainly no Beit Mikdash and no Kohen and no one to bring the Omer to. So where does Avraham Avinu get into this deal? So he says this. He says that the pasuk in Shir HaShirim, if you look on the second part of the sheet here, the pasuk in Shir HaShirim, you see Shir HaShirim, Kol dodei hineza ba medaleg al heharit, mekapetz al hagvot, Kol dodei, my lover, the voice of my lover is coming. Mekapetz al hagvaot. I'm sorry. Medaleg to skip on the mountaintops. Mekapetz and jumps over the valleys. Right? Dome dodi litzvi. My beloved is like a tzvi. What?
Deer.
A deer, right? You know, you can imagine in your minds a deer jumping from one place to another. Ola ofer ha'ayalim. So what is this talking about? Right? What is this talking about? So the commentary that the Panim Yafot is talking about, or that's referring to, that commentary is that's Pesach. That's jumping. Who's jumping? We're jumping. What's the dodi? After all, we know what is the dodi referred to in rabbinic understanding. Dodi is referring to Klal Yisrael, right? The beloved of God. So how is the beloved of God described? Jumping from one hilltop to another, jumping over one valley and the other. Who's jumping? Who's jumping? Am Yisrael. Well, when are they jumping? When were they jumping? So we have talked about this. They were jumping at the time of Yitzhak Mitzrayim. They were, and that's what Pesach is. Pesach is not the jumping of the Malach HaMoves that didn't have to jump. It's the jumping of Am Yisrael, which is, according to the Rav Tzadok, we learned, according to Rav Tzadok HaKohen, this jumping represents the beginning of faith. It's a moment. It's something extreme, right? You don't just jump over mountains, but something could happen that would get you to jump over a mountain. So that there is this pasuk in Shir HaShirim, which, if you like, want to read it the way I've just presented it to you, that indicates that the beginning of faith for Am Yisrael is represented by jumping. It's not that jumping is something that you need to do that is equal to faith. No. I mean, you can jump in the Olympics and that has nothing to do with faith, but jumping represents a kind of uncontrolled act. Something that you can't bridle. You can't put a stop to it. I mean, that's what jumping, Pesach, Piseach, is a word that is applied to the beginning of faith. Something that becomes sort of incomprehensible to you. You don't know why it happened. You don't know why you did it. And that's why you have to be directed to ways to enhance that faith, to change what you are doing, not to leave it be as it was, not to have that momentary experience and then go on. It's not like smoking the hash and then going home and going to sleep. It's not like that. It creates a need. It was the jumping, the religious moment creates a need which, and that need is, how do you keep it going? How do you keep the connection going? So the way you keep the connection going is by bringing a korban pesach, by eating a matzah, by not eating chametz, in other words, as you are directed by God in the way you're supposed to live, well, I mean, it may not be jumping, but it is the protection of the memory of the jumping, and that's why Pesach, the beginning of Pesach, is called Pesach, but the name for the holiday is Chag HaMatzos. In other words, Pesach is the time of an extreme religious reaction to what is going on, and Matzot is the acceptance of the way God wants us to live. Right? There's a certain kind of enhancement here of these two things, and then the Panim Yafot continues. He quotes several pasukim. And he says that this is a description of the future, that in the future, when the Jews are in exile, they'll go through this process again, this process of discovering Pesach, and then Matzot and Chag HaMatzot. All of this is going to happen. And then he says, "V'chein haya b'Avraham shekir et bar'ok shehaya ben menchet shana." In other words, there are these references. Avram Avinu met up with God when he was 48 years old, right? 48 is one day less than 49, 1 year less than 49. He called him Lechera Yeshekuv Memtet Shari Tuma, because who was Avram Avinu? Avram Avinu was Mitchila Ovde Avodah Zorah Yuavoteinu. I know that when you say that, God, most people say Mitchila Ovde Avodah Zorah Yuavoteinu, that's Terah. But he, Rav Pinchas Halevi Yishorowitz, he says, no, that's Avram Avinu. After all, Avram Avinu, 48 years of his life, he lived like an idolater. I mean, he was an idolater. He was like his father. And he says, that's what we mean when we say, Mitchilo Ovdei Avodah Zorah Yuavoteinu, Shneamar, etc. And therefore we understand that there are 50 Share Kedusha. This is what we learn from Avram Avinu. That Avram Avinu was 49 years old, and he had to go through 49 years in order to get to the 50th, in order to get to the Kedusha, to recognize the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was the creator of the world and demanded our attention. Right? We had to be attentive to that fact, as we learn from Avram Avinu. And therefore, in the reconstruction of the beginning of faith, and the beginning of faith is Pesach, right? According to the Panim Yafot, beginning of faith is Pesach, and that continues with mitzvot: eat matzahs, don't eat chametz, and then not only don't eat chametz, but you can't use the new wheat until you bring the korban ha'omer, and then you have to understand that life is a process, 49 levels of Kedusha. And we remind ourselves of that by counting Sfirat HaOmer, and that's the life of Avram Avinu, according to the Panim Yafot. And therefore, the Medrash says that Avram Avinu was the one who got Eretz Yisrael because Avram Avinu kept the Omer. Because of the Omer, it doesn't mean that he brought the Korban Omer, according to the Panim Yafot. but it means that he, in his own life, he became the ultimate model for what we are doing in our own lives. Like, what do we do when we count Sfirat Omer? What are we doing when we're counting another day and another day and another day? And that each day goes up, right? There's another number, and the number is yesterday plus one. He says, so the Parim Yafot means, Avraham Avinu taught us that that's the possibility in real, in the real of things. Even though we may not know it, we may not feel it, we may not always be able to put our fingers on it, but that's what life is about. It's a lot about taking a step up. Take a step up. That's Sfirat HaOmer. Again and again and again. And in order for the Shtei Alechem, in order for the bread, the Chametz sacrifice, to be brought to the Beit HaMikdash, we have to prove that we want it to be, that it has to grow in us. And that's what Sfirat HaOmer is. And therefore the Medrash says, according to the Parim Yafot correctly, it's in Vayikra Rabbah and in the Alkot Shimoni, repeats the Medrash, that this idea that built into, like, at the same time you have like a feeling for the end of things, that's like the beginning of faith. Like, the beginning of faith is really the end. It's just that we can't maintain that level of interaction, but we have to go back and build it up step by step by step. And that's what Avraham Avinu taught us. He was able to do it, and therefore he was zochet to Eretz Yisrael. Have a good Shabbos.